Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Yesterday, the British Parliament rejected the government's exit agreement with the European Union by a 2-to-1 margin. And today, in the United States, the partial government shutdown continues in its 26th day. My guest today says both of these events are emblematic of the weakened state of democratic institutions in the Western democracies. The reason he gives for the weakened state is somewhat counterintuitive. He believes it's the weakness of the two political parties. Weakness in the sense that both parties now cater to their activists on the fringe rather than a majority of their typical voters. And as mainstream voters become disillusioned with the agendas of the party, they seek to increase direct involvement in political decisions through referendums, which in turn weakens institutions further. So says my guest today, Ian Shapiro, a political theorist at Yale University, and his colleague Francis McCall Rosenbluth. They say this weakness goes far beyond the Brexit mess and our ongoing political gridlock here in the U.S. and afflicts democracies in Western Europe, the newly more authoritarian regimes in Eastern Europe, and the Americas. They're co-authors of a provocative new book titled Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It's published by Yale University Press, and Professor Ian Shapiro is my guest today. Ian Shapiro, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book with electoral systems expert Francis McCall Rosenbluth is, as you write, very contrarian to the conventional wisdom about what's wrong with our political system. And the quick takeaway that our political parties need to be stronger might strike a lot of listeners as going, what? But I have to say, it's a very nuanced book. So why would a stronger new two-party system be better for our democracy?
So you're spot on with our diagnosis that most people think, if anything, the parties are so too strong. They seem so polarized, and at the first approximation, that's right. The parties in Congress are more polarized than they've ever been in this last century, and more polarized than the population. And the reason is the dirty little secret really is primaries. And though primaries have been around for more than 100 years in Congress, they've become vastly more important because the vast majority of seats are now safe seats. So that means that in over 90% of congressional races, the only election that matters is the primary. And the problem with primaries is we get extremely low turnout, and it tends to be people on the fringes of both parties. The activists who care most are also at the political extremes. So you can get someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected in a safe seat in New York on an 11% turnout. You can get similar outcomes with Jim Jordan in Ohio on the Republican side, or Mark Meadows, the Freedom Caucus folks. And so then what happens is they go to Washington, and either they make the kinds of compromises that are needed to govern and pass legislation, in which case the people who elected them accuse them of having sold out and, become corrupted by Washington, or they don't, in which case the rest of the voters get alienated by the gridlock and the inability to do anything. So voters get angrier and angrier and more alienated, and they respond by demanding even more direct control. But the problem is that the direct control goes to the people who are going to pull the parties further apart. So in our book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself, we propose the kinds of reforms that could begin to reverse that and turn parties more into teams that are pulling in the same direction rather than collections of individual candidates who are all out for the essentially trying to survive on their own, which makes the party so dysfunctional.
I'd like to get to that in a second, but if I can go back, many people believe that it is the power of the parties which has created those gerrymandered districts in the first place on the federal level and increasingly on a state level that prevents that bipartisan solution or a stronger, more cohesive party to actually get things done in legislation that benefits the people. How would you respond to that, the fact that the parties have really created these gerrymandered districts in the first place?
So you're right about that, but it's not the congressional parties that have done that. It's because we have this system of redistricting being done by the state legislature. And so what happens is either one party's complete control of the state legislature, in which case they do the redistricting to create safe seats for themselves, creating the problem we are talking about, or if there's division, sometimes they'll carve up the state and they'll essentially do a bipartisan deal to create safe seats on both sides. And that's also creates this world in which the only thing that matters are primaries. A number of states have gone to independent commissions. More than a third, actually, of the states have gone to independent commissions. But there, some of them are great, but the majority of them are, in fact, not independent. They're bipartisan. So it's the same as a bipartisan deal in the legislature. Then what would be best is truly independent commissions who are told to design the constituencies so that they reflect America. That's the way you will get candidates running who are going to think about both urban voters and rural voters, for example. It would be much better if most districts included both urban voters and rural voters so that the kind of people running for office in those districts would have to think about the concerns of both groups from the perspective of the other, and you would get more moderate candidates. What we tend to get is, you know, urban districts and rural districts, and we get, you know, blue cities and red states, and this is the kind of thing that then promotes the polarization.
And of course, if you were actually to adopt that, the activists, the people that are clamoring for more power and wanting their policies enacted without compromise, would be marginalized, wouldn't they?
They would have less power. So another one of our proposals is that most Americans don't realize how low the turnout is in primaries. And so one of our proposals is that we don't think you could get rid of primaries in America. They've been around for much too long. But what is, we think, within the realm of where we could actually get to is a rule which said, if the turnout in a primary is less than 75% of the turnout in the previous general election in that district, that then the primary result would be discounted and the candidate would be selected by the congressional party. Because the party leadership has a strong incentive to pick people who can both win in their district and support a national program which everybody can get behind, as I said, on a team. So they would be much more likely to pick, especially if we could reconfigure the districts to look more like one another and to look more like America as a whole, they would be more inclined to pick people who would appeal to a broader cross-section of voters.
That goes against a lot of grains of what our politics has been moving towards. In fact, with more direct control, more primaries, more... referendums as a way of governing. So giving party leaders more control, why is that a better thing?
We're not talking about going back to smoke-filled rooms. We think it, you know, we're all for publicity in what's happening and transparency. But the basic idea is that if parties operate as teams with everybody on the same page, then they have an incentive. If you like, the backbenchers pick the front benches who pick the backbenchers who pick the front benches. Think about a sports team that's trying to have a winning strategy. Obviously, you give huge authority to the coach and to the quarterback, but they also have enough rope to hang themselves in that if they don't deliver victories, they're gone. You know, you don't survive as a coach in the NFL or as a quarterback in the NFL if you're not actually being effective. And so in one sense, you're giving them more power. But in the other sense, you're actually enhancing their ability to pull together. This, by the way, is the same is true with respect to the presidency. There we haven't had primaries for nearly as long, really it's since the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s, we started using primaries. But there have been assaults on the president's connections with Congress, if you like, for a long time. It really goes back to the early 19th century. Until 1824, it was the congressional parties who picked the presidential candidates. And Andrew Jackson unleashed a populist attack on that in 1824 when he lost to John Quincy. 1828, they went to national caucuses. So, and then later we got the progressives and so on and so forth. But if you think about if the congressional parties picked the presidential candidates, the Republicans would never have picked somebody like Donald Trump. They would pick people who would be more like themselves. So you would get more coordination across the branches. Our system would operate in that sense more like a parliamentary system. And so that's what we're advocating. Effective parties that could then run on a platform that they all shared. And if the voters like it, they elect them. And then they're responsible for implementing it. And if they don't or it doesn't work, voters will hold them accountable. Now we have no accountability because, you know, let's suppose things go badly in the next couple of years. You know, Trump will blame the House Democrats and the House Democrats will blame Trump. And the voters will have no way of deciding who is actually to blame. And so we really think that accountability is the most important value in a democracy. And if you had parties that could be effective while they govern in implementing their policies and having everybody get behind them, you know, then we would be able to see who was responsible for what. And now we have a situation in which really that you just get fog and recriminations out of Washington, and it's not surprising voters get so alienated from the system.
One of the things you write about in the book is the importance of having this platform. I mean, the platform, yep. the thing that nobody reads anymore in presidential years, you know, you vote for the person or you vote for the party, but not necessarily on the issues that the party stands for. It's more, I think in America, a lot of times it has to do with tradition and maybe a few campaign issues that an individual candidate is standing for rather than the party platform. Why would a platform be so important?
Well, the platform now is irrelevant because the parties consist of, you know, in Congress, consist basically of scores of free agents, or maybe hundreds of free agents who all have to do what they have to do in order to survive. You know, Ocasio-Cortez is going to have to fight with the Democratic leadership or she'll face a primary challenge and she'll be accused of having sold out. It's the same thing, you know, with the Senate leader. He would be looking at a primary challenge in Kentucky if he did anything other than what he's doing now. So the platforms, everybody knows the platforms, you know, the Republican platforms had a pro-life constitutional amendment in it forever, but nobody really believes that they're going to be able to pursue that in office. So the platforms are just essentially things that the activists in the parties extract to try and move the candidates in their direction. If you really think what we mean is, think about, you mentioned referendums and ballot initiatives. The thing about a ballot initiative is it extracts one issue. For instance, you can ask American voters, should we get rid of the estate tax, which is paid by less than 2% of the population, with the states of above $20 million, 70% will say yes. But if you say to them, should we get rid of the estate tax if it means getting rid of prescription drug benefits for seniors, overwhelming majority say no. So what are we forcing them to do in the second case that we're not forcing them to do in the first? We're essentially saying, discount your preference for getting rid of the estate tax by your preference for having prescription drug benefits for seniors. And when they do that discounting, they come out somewhere else. So that's what parties do when they put together platforms that they're actually going to run on and implement. They have to discount everything they propose by everything else that they propose and do it in a way that they think most voters will support. And if they get it wrong, they'll lose. If they get it right, they'll win. When you let voters just pull out some issue and vote on it separately, they don't have to do that discounting. This is how you can look what's going on in the UK today. We're confronted with this fact that when given a referendum on Brexit, the majority of voters voted no, because they could pull that out and not think about its costs for in terms of employment and relocation of families and a whole variety of other issues and trade and exports.
There's annual Spanish vacation, for example, along the Costa
exactly.
del Sol. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. I mean, there's lots of things there.
But the reason both the Parliamentary Labour Party and the Parliamentary Conservative Party are pro-Remain is that they have done that bundling, and both of them know that actually doing Brexit doesn't make any sense given all the other things that British voters care about. So you get this apparent contradiction that the same voters who have elected these parties to Parliament that are strongly pro-Remain, when consulted just about Brexit, say, leave. It's just like Proposition 13 in California, which, you know, limited property taxes when people didn't have to think about the costs for public schools, local government, and so on.
My guest today is Ian Shapiro, a professor of political science at Yale University and co-author with Francis McCall Rosenbluth of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It's published by Yale University Press. You mentioned you would like to see more of a parliamentary system of running within our own congressional system here in America. But in your book, you write that, you know, the parliamentary system in Britain is not all that great. You spend quite a bit of time about Brexit and the fact that there are still stresses even within the British system, which does run mainly on a unified party platform.
Yeah, so the phenomenon we're talking about is not restricted to America by any stretch of the imagination. And indeed, in our book, we have chapters on Britain and France and Germany and Eastern Europe and Latin America. And this phenomenon of angry voters demanding more and more direct control has come up at virtually everywhere, but it plays itself out differently. So in Britain, for example, They've introduced a system of direct election of the leader by the membership of the party. And who is the membership of the party? They, again, are like U.S. primary voters. They are far to the left of the typical Labour voter, never mind the typical British voter. And so what happens is they elect Jeremy Corbyn, who's far on the left fringe of the Labour Party. The Parliamentary Labour Party then voted a vote of no confidence in Corbyn by 172-40. Think about that. That's a huge majority. And then what happened? The membership reelected Corbyn by 62%. So now imagine, you know, that Theresa May loses an election, which is quite likely because she's made a bunch of blunders and so on, and Labour gets back into office. You're going to have a parliamentary Labour Party being led by somebody who's policies they can't possibly support. So the old system was that the Parliamentary Labour Party used to pick its own leader, and the Parliamentary Conservative Party used to pick their own leader. That's no longer true. And so decentralizing reforms have happened all over the world. Same thing in Germany, which was often held out as, you know, the most well-functioning European system. They've got fragmented parties that are controlled by smaller and smaller subgroups, making it virtually impossible for them to govern. And we detail these pathologies in our book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. And we recommend different reforms in the different countries because they have different kinds of electoral systems. You know, we don't want to reinvent the world from scratch. We think you have to start from where you are and then move in the direction of more cohesive and stronger parties that can be held accountable by voters.
One of the tenets of our parties is they strive to be a big tent. And that means, say, in the Democratic Party, it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but it could also be a downstate Illinois congressman that's really has to be fairly conservative.
Yeah.
If you do have a unified party platform that the party is going to run on, doesn't that risk splintering the parties into a series of smaller parties? It would actually destroy the two-party system.
If you have single-member districts, we have something in political science called Duverger's Law. if you have single-member districts, you will end up with two parties, provided the districts look more or less like the country. If, say, in India, they have single-member districts but huge regional variation, so they still get lots of parties. But if you basically have big, diverse districts, you're going to end up with two parties. They might not be the same. The axis of competition can change, as happened here in the 1850s when the Whigs disintegrated and were eventually replaced by the Republicans in 1860. So you will basically tend to get two parties. We think that's good because when you have multiple parties, again, you have lack of accountability because they always have to put together coalition governments after the election. And then later on, each party to the coalition will blame the other coalition member. And again, voters don't really know who to hold responsible. So we're not against a two-party system. What we're against is a two-party system that's controlled by where each party increasingly is controlled by its own extreme fringes, which is what we've created with primaries. So that's why I keep coming back to primaries. I don't like to sound like a Johnny One Note, but it really is the core of the problem. They didn't used to matter that much because, A, we didn't use them in the presidential system, and, B, we didn't have the vast majority of seats being safe seats where the primary is the only election that matters. But now that is the reality we're dealing with. And so just as almost all the states are irrelevant to the presidential elections, almost all of the general elections are irrelevant as to who winds up in Congress. Everything gets decided in the primaries. We really have to address that.
I think it might be surprising to a lot of people that even as recent as 1968, one of the two parties put forward a candidate that really didn't win any primaries. The candidates won the primary were the anti-war candidates. Of course, one was assassinated, Robert Kennedy, on the Democratic side. But Eugene McCarthy won primaries, and yet the party leaders chose Hubert Humphrey, who didn't win practically any primaries.
Yeah, and it was unfortunate that it was the smoke-filled rooms and party leaders who were not the congressional leaders of the parties, as had been the case in the U.S. until 1828, because that fed the narrative of, these were corrupt bargains being made by people with other agendas and so forth. And so we're not talking about going back to the smoke-filled rooms. We're talking about creating more diverse districts, putting some constraints on what primary electors can do in very low turnout primaries, and limiting their effect, particularly in presidential elections, so you don't have the situation where you're pushing in the wrong direction. You know, for instance, the Democrats have just shot themselves in the foot yet again. In 2016, the Sanders people extracted a commitment from the Democratic Leadership Council that in exchange for supporting Hillary Clinton, the superdelegates would be bound in future on the first vote by the primary election outcome, even though, in fact, Sanders lost regardless of the superdelegates. So they've now created the system the Republicans already have, which was what made it impossible for them to stop Donald Trump. Because the superdelegates in the Republican side were bound by the primary outcome in the first ballot. So in effect, superdelegates are a Band-Aid on a bad system. It would be much better not to have party bigwigs and former mayors and so forth and former presidents, but the actual members of the party in the legislature having a much bigger say in the selection of leaders, both in the legislature and for the presidential contest. And until we do that, we're going to continue to have these hugely fragmented parties. And by the way, everybody complains about money in politics. They all focus on the supply of money, the donors, the lobbyists, and so forth. But what people don't talk about is the demand for money. Why do these politicians all need so much money? And the reason they need so much money is that everybody is freelancing. Everybody's running their own campaign. That's much more expensive. If you look at countries with stronger parties like Britain, despite the fact that they've been messing it up in some ways, their campaigns are much cheaper because they really are all campaigning on one platform, and wholesale campaigning is just much cheaper than retail campaigning.
And they last, 45 days?
Yeah, exactly. And the candidates are not all running to bring home goodies to their constituencies, which is what happens when the parties are weak. And you get so much log rolling and all the things that make Americans want to throw up when they watch what's going on in Washington. So stronger and more cohesive parties would promote political accountability, and that's what we're arguing for in responsible parties saving democracy from itself.
Ian Shapiro, what would be a good first step in your view of reforming the American political system?
I think the good first step would be limiting the power of primaries. So by introducing a rule which said if turnout in the primary falls below 75% of the turnout in the previous general election in that district, the parties in Congress would select the candidate instead. I think another small step would be to copy the states like California, which have now gone to genuinely independent commissions, not bipartisan ones that just carve up states between them, but ones that will design districts to be competitive between the parties so that the general election starts to matter again, and what's at issue between the parties is what the voters actually vote on. Those would be the two most important steps.
Well, let me ask you, California also has a top two, where it's an open primary and the top two advance to the general election. Is that a good reform?
No, that's not. That's what so-called jungle primaries. That's a mistake, we think, because, again, what you're doing then is you're looking for candidates who are trying to differentiate themselves from one another by promising local goods to the constituency. I'm going to bring more back to the district than that person is going to bring back to the district. That just produces, you get celebrity candidates running and so on. That just produces log rolling and, again, weak party leadership, you know, particularly in California, where you can wind up with, you know, the top two candidates both being from the same party. This doesn't help with cohesive platforms where voters are going to get a choice. So while we give California an A plus on moving to independent commissions for districting, we give them a D minus for going to jungle primaries.
All right, Professor. Indeed, good. The name of the book is Responsible Parties. It's a very provocative look at what's wrong with our political system. Ian Shapiro, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ian Shapiro is a professor of political science at Yale University. He and his colleague at Yale, Francis McCall Rosenbluth, are the co-authors of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It's published by Yale University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.